The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio. Mino Studio is a pre- and post-production facility for all of your audio needs. Mino Studio's founder is an accredited audio engineer with top 40 and indie album credits. With over 30 years of music industry experience, Mino Studio can take your podcast from idea to reality. Contact Mino Studio at MinoStudio777@gmail.com for more information. That's Mino Studio spelled M-E-N-O. MinoStudio777@gmail.com.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manicero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manicero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes, type in Old Dog, spelled D-A-W-G, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, today's guest, we have a great guest here, Bree Schmidt. Bree started purchasing investment properties in 2011 when she founded BBS Apartments. She currently owns and manages 90-plus rental units in Chicago and Milwaukee. Bree utilizes her extensive knowledge of building and managing a portfolio to teach clients about all aspects of buy and hold investing. She owns her own brokerage company in Illinois and Wisconsin and works with both new investors and seasoned investors looking to expand their portfolios. Bree is also the president of TurnkeyReviews.com, the one-stop shop for passive investing in real estate, residential real estate across the United States. With over 100 providers and 25 cash-flowing markets, it is the most comprehensive site on buying turnkey properties. Well, Bree, welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. And you've got a great background and a lot of experience in the real estate area as a agent, as well as an investor and broker and turnkey. I mean, you're all over the place. It's great.
It's taken over my life.
Oh, it's great. I think you've got so
much.
In a
good way.
Yeah. You've got so much to offer our guests. I think it's great that you can come at it from so many different angles. So maybe you could just kind of give us a rough run of how you got involved in real estate investing.
Well, it wasn't really intentional. I live in the city of Chicago, and my husband and I were looking to get married and start a life, and we didn't have kids, and you know, we wanted to buy real estate, and we really, really wanted long-term, a forever home. In our market, though, a lot of the housing is 2 to 4 unit properties, and single family homes tend to be, you know, over $100,000 more expensive than a 2 to 3 unit property. So we decided to buy a 3 unit property, live in 1 unit, rent out the others. And then eventually down the road, once our family grew, we would just deconvert it to a single family. Then it ended up being a lot easier than we thought it was. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
Oh, that's neat. So you didn't really have an intention of, say, growing to a certain size or acquiring a certain number of units?
No, even up till the first year, it was just going to be that one. The next year, we started, you know, toying with the idea of maybe growing more. And that's when our goal was originally to do 4 properties with, then we would buy a single family for ourselves. And now we have over 30. So I don't really set goals anymore because my mind always changes and what we always end up doing. I focus a lot on what I feel like my gut instinct tells me to do. So we've changed our plans a million times over and gone back and forth, and that's how we've gotten to where we are now.
As a real estate agent as well, you're sort of working both sides. You're obviously looking at properties for other people, but you're also looking at potential properties for yourselves. Is that correct?
Correct. Well, my current acquisition goals and process is in the city of Milwaukee. And I currently work with clients to invest properties in the city of Chicago. So I never want to compete with clients. So I keep those kind of separate in different states. I don't take on clients in Milwaukee, and I don't currently buy property in Chicago.
Oh, interesting. Now, is there a certain reason why you would do that, or is it just sort of the economics of it?
There's different kinds of markets, right? The way I see it, there's 3 different kinds of markets. There's an appreciation-based market, which tends to be the coastal cities, you know, where you're not really investing for cash flow, but you're investing for long-term appreciation gains. And there's the more balanced markets like Chicago, where you're getting cash flow. It's not fantastic. You're looking at, you know, a 7-8 cap type property, at least the areas that I work in. And then you've got moderate appreciation growth over time. Then you've got cash flow cities like Milwaukee, where the sole purpose is to generate cash flow, and you're expecting to sell the property in 10 years what you paid for it. So my personal portfolio is split about 50-50 between Chicago and Milwaukee. So I like having those 2 different strategies within the market. And so I work with investors that are local to me. It's an area that I know better. And they're sort of following the strategy that I did, which is I bought in a more expensive market with appreciation. And over the last few years, we've been able to cash out on our investments and then parlay that money into different markets with a different strategy.
Gotcha. And what are those various markets that you're investing in?
Just me, Chicago and Milwaukee.
Okay. I'm in Southern California here, and we have a crazy market, you know, with very compressed cap rates and, you know, prices that are just sky high. But many feel that we're sort of at the top of the bubble right now, or at least it's, you know, not likely to go too much higher in price. Where in Milwaukee, where would you say you are in terms of prices right now for properties?
We just started seeing prices start to increase to go closer to pre-boom rates about 1.5 years ago. So it's just on the uptick of things. Now, I mean, Chicago is 90 minutes away from Milwaukee. But investing out of state, even if you're quote-unquote investing for cash flow, there's a lot more that goes into it than just buying a duplex in somewhere, a city halfway across the country and making money off of it. So a lot of the properties I bought, I try to do exit interviews with sellers when I purchase stuff. And I would say about 1/3 of the properties I've purchased were from out-of-state investors that were failing. So I would always, you know, after the deal was done, it was closed, they, you know, I couldn't go back. I would call them and hopefully get a candid conversation with them about why they were selling, like what went wrong. And the biggest lesson I learned from that experience was it's really hard in these quote-unquote cash flow markets. We call them high touch. So it's a lot more work. There, you know, your vacancy, your turnover, your expenses are a lot higher. It's a lot more day to day. And if you only have 1 or 2 duplexes in the area, it's very hard to be a priority to your property manager. So I had sellers that were telling me it was 6-9 months for a vacancy. And I'm like, if my property manager, you know, took 6-9 months for a vacancy, like I would be up there in his office, you know, screaming at him and asking what was going on. Plus I own so many properties in the area that when I ask for something, it's usually done within 24 hours.
Right. Do you have the property managers for all your properties, or do you manage any of those yourself?
That's a great question. I self-manage my stuff in Chicago.
Okay.
And I have a property manager in Milwaukee. We used to have an in-house property management team. So I built that team up when we first started, and it ended up requiring way too much of my work or of my time. So about a little over a year ago, we left them, phased them out, and went to a professional property management company, which is more expensive, but a lot less time and stress for me.
Was that a difficult move? I mean, especially since, you know, when you have your own property management company, you have more control, you set your standards. Going to an outside property manager, obviously there's certain things that are going to be different.
Oh, of course. It was an adjustment period for a lot of different things. I'm kind of a control freak. So I had to keep reminding myself that, you know, I think our properties represent about 20% of their portfolio. So I'm no longer the only client, right? I'm no longer the boss. So I have to also understand that they might have other priorities that are going on right now. And if my thing is not an emergency, then I have to step back and allow them the time to handle it in what they feel is appropriate. The second part of it also was learning to trust them. And I really, really believe that my property manager now has my best interest in mind. And we've gotten definitely to a point where, you know, I don't question him very much, or I try not to on his decisions. But I had to remind myself that I hired them for a reason. You know, I interviewed them and did background checks and all that stuff. And that, you know, I'm paying them to do something for me, and I should allow them to do it how they best see fit. Now, that ended up costing us some money over the year, because there's obviously growing pains and, you know, in different situations that came up. But overall, I think it was the best thing we ever did, because again, it allowed me, I was up there every week. So I went from about 30 hours a week managing that business to about 15 to 20 hours a month.
God, that's great. That's great. Now, between the two states, Illinois and Wisconsin, would you say they are about the same in terms of being the landlord-tenant laws?
That's a great question. Chicago, apparently we have one of the strictest landlord-tenant laws that is very, very pro-tenant. I don't have a problem with it. So I've been buying in Chicago for almost 6 years. I've read the rules. You know, it's like a 40-page rule book. I've never come into a situation where I ever had a problem or a questionable situation under the law. To me, it's pretty black and white. You know, just follow the rules and you'll be fine. But a lot of people have problems or say that they're against our landlord-tenant laws. Milwaukee is opposite. Milwaukee is pretty pro-landlord. But again, I've never really run into a situation in either cities that the law got involved, or, you know, there was ever really a discrepancy that caused the landlord-tenant laws to be a situation. I think that if you provide good, clean units, you're going to attract tenants that want to rent good, clean units. And it's going to be a much better situation for everyone when you're doing that.
Yeah, it's a big difference. Same here as a Southern California investor. I buy everything out of state, and part of that decision process is really assessing the, you know, how landlord friendly that state is, because boy, it can make such a difference on an eviction or numerous other things if they aren't friendly to the landlords.
Correct. Yeah, I've heard about California's eviction laws.
Oh, it's crazy.
Chicago, it's apparently supposed to take 6 months. I've never had to do an eviction in Chicago, because the markets that I invest in tend to be AB neighborhoods. So it's not, I've really never even had tenants pay late. Milwaukee, I can get someone out in about 2 to 3 weeks, if I'm fast about it, but definitely 30 days. And there's very little for them to go back on. I mean, literally, you go to court and the judge asks, you know, you owe X amount of dollars. Are you saying that you don't owe that? And they're usually like, no, I do owe that. And they're like, okay, you want them out or what? Like, it's as simple as that.
That's great.
You know, there's like the excuses or like they'll ramble, like they don't care. Like, if you owe money and the landlord wants you out, within 10 days, the sheriff will be there moving your stuff out.
Yeah. In California, I know some people that have surpassed a year in trying to get someone out. I mean, just ridiculous. Makes it really, really difficult to, you know, to do any kind of property in transactions here. Well, one of the things we like to ask our guests is the information that will help our listeners who are learning and are trying to expand their education, you know, to share things that the learning moments. And one of those is to ask, what is your biggest mistake you feel you made in the process of your investing?
So I think the biggest mistake I made is I had a period of what people call analysis paralysis. It was a time period where I wasn't sure what we were going to do. We had just did a large cash out refinance on our personal residence, which was a live and flip property. And we just didn't know what direction to go to. And so I had spent about 6 months, you know, reading about different types of investing and different kinds of investing and different areas of investing. And it really caused me to start to doubt myself. And it took me stepping back and saying, okay, like, what are you good at? What do you want to do? And I started like a checklist of different kinds of investing. You know, this one's going to be more hands-on, and it will give me, you know, higher cash flow. But this one's, you know, more hands-off, and it will give me, you know, lower cash flow. I kind of went through and finally decided what we were going to do with everything. And that was our decision to move forward with Milwaukee. But it took me about 6 months, and I really started to self-doubt myself. I also call it like shiny object syndrome. You know, it was like as soon as I thought like I knew what I wanted to do, there was something that was cool or new or shiny that distracted me. It was like, oh, maybe we'll do that instead. And I thought, what if I would have just followed with what I know and then followed with what my gut told me I should do? Then we wouldn't have wasted that 6 months, and we would have probably missed out on some opportunities by doing so.
Right. Conversely, what would you say was your biggest success as an investor?
That would be trusting our gut instinct. So our third property, like I said, was a live and flip. We had just purchased another property. We had not planned to do anything for a while. We really didn't have the money to do it either because the rehab costs. We had a very, very tight budget. So logically and financially, we probably shouldn't have bought this house because we went up way over our budget on rehab. We had to put, you know, money on 0% interest credit cards and cut back on a lot of things to pay off the cost of it. But in the end, the equity that we received from this house has been, you know, above and beyond what we expected. And it was probably the best decision we ever made.
Wow. Well, as you know, our audience are 50-plussers, people that are either approaching retirement or already in retirement that are looking at real estate investing as a means to be able to supplement their retirement or to better prepare them for retirement. And some of the folks may have, you know, sort of looking at their what funds they have for retirement are thinking, oh boy, you know, I'm not going to have enough to get started, may not have a lot to invest, or some may have, you know, a little nest egg set aside that they can get started with. But how would you advise somebody that, you know, really maybe hasn't, outside of buying their own home, been a real estate investor, how would you advise them to get started out and maybe give them a bit of advice, you know, from your own experience, even though you're not an old dog here, but just an idea of how you think it would be a good way to approach it from your own experience?
So, I mean, there's different avenues of investing, right? You can, you know, flip properties, which probably isn't something that you know, want to do if you're, you know, in your 50s, there's the avenue of being a private investor. So you can loan money to people to flip properties and then collect a preferred return. You can invest in funds, you can invest in notes, you can do buy and hold. I mean, there's a million different aspects of real estate investing. So I would start learning about different aspects of real estate investing first and kind of discern like what your niche would be. For me, I'm buy and hold. It's this, you know, slow and steady wins the race kind of idea. So I invest money, my tenants pay my mortgage, and I receive a monthly profit every month. That works for me. I'm in my early 30s. By the time I'm in my 60s, those properties will be completely paid off. That might not be the best avenue for someone that's, let's say, looking to retire currently or is currently retired, but that's my favorite avenue. Just with, again, like long-term appreciation gains, it's generally pretty easy. It's an easy avenue to learn because you just really need to learn the market. And once you understand the market, you'll be able to determine if it's a good investment or not. And my other thing, I guess, would be, you know, make sure if you are going to do something with someone or invest in a fund or whatever it may be, background checks, you know, do your due diligence. You can never be too diligent, especially when you're investing, let's say, your life savings in something.
Right. And that's where I think a lot of people are at. We have a tend to lean toward cash flow and probably the more the buy and hold aspect in our program here, but you know, we do feature people from various aspects, that flippers and so forth, that people can get a chance to, you know, to see what some of these other aspects are. But you know, definitely, I think in terms of you know, getting started, I think people are just cautious. You know, here's their nest egg; they've been saving their whole life, and you know, they're not real quick to jump into, you know, something that that might maybe a gamble. And so, you know, that's a big concern, I think, of those listening.
There's different markets. There's different ways to do investing. The way I see things is the cheaper the property and the cheaper the area, the more work it's going to be day to day, and the more wide swinging, right, things are going to be. Versus if you go in a more like expensive area with AB tenants, I can tell you, like, sometimes I don't talk to my tenants for a year. The only time I talk to my tenants a lot of times is when they have lease renewals. And so it's a lot more hands off for me. But again, I'm getting less cash flow. So there's different risks and rewards within buy and hold real estate. I think you need to weigh all those and where you're at with your life and determine which one's best for you.
How would you describe sort of your target property?
Well, it's different between the two. You know, Chicago, you're looking at, you know, $500,000 property around. Usually it's already finished with granite, stainless, in a good area, and it probably generates $4,500 a month. In Milwaukee, I might be looking at, you know, $100,000 property that generates, you know, $1,400 a month. But I caution people, especially at this point in their life, the biggest lesson I learned from investing out of state, and even though it's 90 minutes away, so I can be there in an hour and a half and handle something if it needs to be handled, is in that type of market, which I consider to be a BC type market, bad things happen. And when bad things happen, they happen all at once. So I could have a property that, you know, it's easy peasy for 2 years, the tenants stay, we've got very little expenses on it. And then all of a sudden, one tenant stops paying, the other tenant leaves. Next thing you know, I've got 3 months of vacancy. I've got thousands of dollars of repairs, you know, and it just happens, and it always happens at once. So if that's your only property, it's very hard for people to go through those waves and those up and downs, because it will happen. When you've got multiple properties in an area, if I've got one property that's underperforming currently, I've got a bunch that are performing. So at the end of the day, my month end numbers typically look the same, but it's balanced over, you know, 25 different properties. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's okay. a great explanation. And that's something that, you know, I want to bring up again as sort of a question here is, you described the situation almost to the T that I experienced. I started buying single family, and I had a couple of duplexes. But what I was finding is that the duplexes were already outperforming the single family homes. Plus, I had that backup that if one tenant was gone, I had the other, you know, tenant that was going to be, you know, paying and likely covering the mortgage. So I, you know, quickly sort of moved into the mode of looking at multis and larger multis, and that's really where I'm at today is investing in larger apartments where I don't have those same problems I had with single family. Has that been something that you've looked at and examined as far as your future and your investment strategy?
So I've never actually owned a single family. I only do multis or small multis. It's mainly because of the markets that I invest in are more dense urban environments. So it's normal for an A, B type tenant to be renting an apartment because in the areas that I work in, over half the housing is 2 to 4 unit properties. In some of the areas, it's about 75% of the housing. So wow. It's very common to rent a duplex in those areas versus if I was investing in, you know, let's say Kansas City, an A-class tenant is going to be renting a single-family house, not part of a duplex. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So it also goes to tenant class for me. But, yeah, I mean, with the multis, there's different pros and cons. You know, the turnover can be higher because if you're getting a single-family, they might stay 3, 4, or 5 years. In the markets that I invest in, there's certain utilities that cannot be split up between tenants. And if it was a single family house, the tenants would be paying those utilities. So that's something else to consider. And it's always, to me, it always goes to how the people get along. You know, I've got properties where the tenants have been there together for 5, 6 years. They get along really well. You know, but if one tenant goes, chances are the other tenant's going to go as well. I've also had properties where we were like 3 or 4 months into it, and I was like, you know what, get renewed both of their leases, because they're both being brats. They're both calling us complaining about the other one. I don't know who's right, so let's just tell them both that we're not renewing their lease and get them out and start over. So, you know, it goes both sides of the coin on it, right?
Right, that's true. Well, looking at your business, you know, now you are your husband and you are both working full time. In other areas besides real estate investing?
I work full-time in real estate investing.
Okay, you do. Okay, so that is your full-time gig.
Uh-huh.
Okay, how do you see your business in, you know, 10 years, 20 years down the road? Where do you want to go to? What is your vision, you know, for the future of your company?
It's going to go one of two ways. Either I'm going to double, if not triple, what we currently have, or I'm going to sell it all and do something else. Like I said, when we buy properties, I try to do exit interviews with sellers, or when I'm even looking at properties, if I'm having the appointment directly with the seller, I always ask, why are you selling? And they always have, like, everyone keeps telling me, you know, I just hit that point where I'm done. You know, I'm over it. I don't feel like doing it. It's usually owners who own, let's say, less than 10, 15 properties. And I always ask, how long have you been doing it? And their response is always 10 years.
Interesting.
And so, wow. Like every single time it's like 10 years. I'm like, really? So I'm about 5.5 years in. If you asked me 3 years ago what my answer would be, I'm like, I would have 100 properties in 10 years. But now that I'm 5.5 years in, I can kind of see where it's like, yeah, you know what? Maybe I would just cash out. It all depends on the market too. You know, there's a lot going on with our current economy and our future. Who knows where that's going to be? You know, if I can sell my properties and double what I made off them, I won't be a landlord anymore. I will sell them off. You know, if the market crashes again and, you know, I can't sell the properties where I paid for them, then I will continue to hold them and just, you know, have the rental income pay off my mortgage.
Right. So it's a lot will depend on sort of what's going on economically and also with you personally in terms of how you're enjoying what you're doing, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things we mentioned in your bio was the fact that you have this this website for Turnkey, which is a great resource that I want to make sure that those listening know. Not only will everything that Bree and I discuss be in our show notes here, but I'd also like to make a link to the turnkey website that you have, because this is an area where I get a lot of questions. We've had various guests that talk about turnkey. I've shared a lot about my experiences because my first three properties that I bought were all turnkey. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe you could just talk a little bit about what that resource is and what kind of information they can expect to get there.
Of course. So the site was started about 2 years ago. And as I was explaining earlier, I don't buy turnkey properties. I never have. I almost did. And I can tell you about that experience. And I don't sell turnkey properties either. I really got no involvement within the turnkey business. But it was a website called Bigger Pockets. It was a friend of mine, and we were just, you know, reading articles, and we paid attention to the website. And it just seemed every week there was someone complaining about either losing money or what to do about a turnkey property that they bought across the country, and it was going south. And so, you know, we realized there was no resource out there that helped people share their experiences or hear others' experiences about a specific turnkey company. So we started the website. It's a Yelp-type review site. Anyone can go on, read reviews, write reviews. And so our intentions were just, again, to start a due diligence process. You know, if you were looking at the Indianapolis market, you can go on our site and see Indianapolis and look at, you know, a couple of different turnkey providers and read what their clients are saying about them in a not like agnostic environment, right? Because they're not getting paid to do so. Through that site, I've also hosted my own podcast where I interview turnkey buyers about their experiences, good, bad, you know, and which ones, you know, had very positive experiences, are continuing to grow. And then there's obviously horror stories. Unfortunately, you know, that's going to happen. I would guess from what I at least have learned in the past couple of years, about 10% of the stories are horror stories. But that's what people talk about, right? So I try to get guests on who have had a bad experience so they can share with other people who can learn not to do that. And, you know, what did they do wrong and what could you do differently? Because again, it's a lot of money and you're investing for your life and your retirement, and to just hand it over to a stranger halfway across the country and expect the best. I mean, that's just not realistic.
Do you ever have a problem with, in terms of sort of monitoring to make sure that these reviews that people are posting are legit, you know, that it's not everybody, every employee of that company, that turnkey company that's, you know, dialing up and maybe sway the reviews a little bit?
So we do not really have control. Like we can control the posts. You know, we see who, like what email address wrote the post. So if it's a company email address, we just send them a message saying that this post is not going to be posted on our website unless you can show us that that person that works for you is actually a client as well. There's also the ability to report posts. So any post that's flagged goes through a review process. So for that post to remain on the site, they have to show us that they, like either a contract or something, that they are a actual customer of the company. And that goes with both good and bad reviews. As long as they can show a contract that they've done business with that company, or a purchase agreement, or a property management agreement, then the review stays on the website.
Great. Well, that's an excellent resource. And like I said, we're going to post a link on our show notes for those that want to explore that further. What about your podcast? What's the name of your podcast that you do?
It's called the Turnkey Investing Podcast. So it's pretty new. Like I said, my intentions were to kind of get more in the nitty gritty about people's experiences. You know, again, some people have really, really good experiences. So what was it about their experience or what they did differently that made it positive? And for me, the take back I've received is it really comes down to expectations. I find the people that are running their own numbers tend to be a little bit more conservative about their expectations going forward. Understand that it's not going to be perfect 12 months out of the year, that you are going to have rough spots, you are going to have vacancies, but they plan for that, tend to have a very positive outlook on it and tend to want to do it further. The other thing, again, is scale, right? If you're a priority to the property management company, then they're very communicative and responsive to you, they tend to have a good experience. On the flip side, I also like to interview people who have got bad experiences. And I think that that boils down to lack of experience and lack of due diligence. It's mind-blowing to me that people wouldn't fly out to these cities and go see these properties or see the rehab work or meet these turnkey operators. They're just wiring funds without ever actually being to this city before. And that's where I find the people that had bad experiences, you know, really, really lacked on the due diligence side of things, you know, or didn't have what I call like agnostic partners. You know, find your own inspector. Don't use the one that they're asking you to use. Always get a property inspection. Never rely on just pictures. There's networking sites out there for real estate investors. Find someone who's local. And I always say, like, pay them $100 to go to the inspection for you. And, you know, be like, they'll tell you, like, oh my gosh, I saw this thing and it looks awful. Or, you know, I walked through with the inspector and it was great. There's all these things you can do for your due diligence if you can't physically be there. But make sure you're being you're diligent on things.
Great advice. Great advice.
One other question that's relevant here too is you also have your own brokerage
company. So you obviously are a licensed broker. Is that something you'd advise people to do that want to go into real estate investing, is to maybe get their license? Or are there certain times where it's sort of a hindrance?
I never found it to be a hindrance. I mean, I've been licensed since 2004. So even before I like did real estate as an investor or as a job, I was still licensed. It was just inactive. So I've never felt it to be a hindrance. I mean, you have to disclose that you're an agent. It's not that hard. I've always seen it as a benefit. It just really depends on your volume level. I kept my license inactive for about 10 years because it just didn't really have any need for it. So it depends on your state and it depends on your, you know, your dues. But, you know, the licensing can cost $2,000 to get your license. And then I pay about $2,000 a year just to have my license active. So if you're, you know, not buying enough to cover that cost, it may be a hindrance financially for you. But I don't think professionally or as far as access or disclosures or doing anything, it has ever been a hindrance.
What would you say the benefit of would be?
I'm kind of a loner. I like to be able to go see things on my own time. So I don't want to rely on someone else to schedule an appointment or work around their schedule. That's to me the biggest benefit. And I can write my own offers and do things on my own time. So that's actually, I was not licensed in Wisconsin until 2014 when I had trouble finding an agent that I trusted. I finally found a property that I liked. I asked her on a Friday to write an offer for me, you know, told her all the terms. I'm like, I'm going to be out of town, so give it to me and I'll sign it Monday. You know, Monday afternoon comes along. I'm like, where's my offer? She's like, oh, I'm working on it now. And then like 4:30 comes along. I'm like, I have to leave the office. I don't want to have access to, you know, sign and scan it back. I need this offer. She's like, I'm still working on it. And then she started asking me questions about the terms that I'd emailed her on Friday. I'm like, what were you doing for the past 4 days?
Right.
You know, like if I lost this house because you took 4 days to read a damn email. And so luckily I did not lose the house. But that is why I got licensed in Wisconsin. Because I'm able to just do my own stuff at my own pace and write offers quickly, and see properties when I want to see them on my own schedule.
Do you take a commission on every deal you do?
Yes and no. So with my own personal portfolio, especially in the Milwaukee market, about half of our purchases in the past year and a half have been off market. Either through sellers I've purchased from before, or because I deal in a very like a 3 mile radius, people tend to know if they're getting, you know, an off market portfolio that I buy in that area. So I would say about half of our stuff I get before it hits the MLS, just because of the volume I've done so far in the neighborhood. Otherwise, I do get a commission on it, but I also have the option of foregoing my commission.
That's
and
true.
Saying, you know, yeah, if it's a multiple offer situation, I can let go of my commission, save you some money, and get a more competitive offer.
Sure. That's great. Great information. Well, our time has zipped by, and unfortunately, because I have like a million other questions I want to ask you, and we have at this point what we call our wrap it up section, and this is where we ask you a series of quick questions, and so you can give us sort of quick responses regarding resources that you use and so forth, and a little bit of advice as well. So If you're ready, we'll go ahead and move into our wrap it up session.
Sure.
All right. Favorite real estate book?
I've got two. Hold is one of them, and the other one is The Millionaire Real Estate Investor.
That's great. Hold is actually one of my favorites, and I have never guess have ever mentioned that. So that's
really
great. I'm glad to hear
it's
that.
It's a great book.
It's a really
I actually
good.
Give it to all my clients that buy properties with me as investors. It's one of the books that I give them at the closing for them to get, you know, learn the process and learn to be investors.
Yeah, I agree. A great, great book. Favorite business book?
It's sort of a business book, but it's called The One Thing.
Yes.
So it's more of a psychological life sort of book, but I think it bleeds into the rest of your life and business.
Yeah, that's a great book. Most valuable website for success other than your own?
BiggerPockets.com.
Yeah, that's our most popular, and I agree with you. It's one of my favorites. How about favorite app that you have on your phone that you use for your business?
I really don't use apps for my business in general. I'm such a computer. I can't use a tablet to do stuff. I'm old school on a laptop. But I think the best app I like is Mint.com. It's a personal finance management website. But why I like it is it tracks all of your expenses and it sets up budgets for you. I think that one of the most important things, at least for me, growing the business is having to make sacrifices financially. You know, I can't be spending $10 a day on Starbucks if I want to be a millionaire someday. So it helps keep me in check with where my spending is and where I'm at with my goals and my savings goals.
Gotcha. How about favorite quote?
My favorite quote is from a movie from the 90s that no one's maybe not heard of. but the movie is called Empire Records. And the quote was, I do not regret the things I've done, but those I did not do. And that's always stuck with me throughout my life.
Great. Now, our final question here. If, for example, you lost everything, just something cataclysmic happened economically and so forth, and all you had was $1,000, what would you do with that money to sort of relaunch your real estate investing business?
Well, it depends on the market and the price point. If I had nothing, I would use that $1,000 towards a down payment on an FHA house, which is 3.5% down. I live in one unit and rent out the other units, hopefully being able to live rent free and, you know, keep saving up and then grow it again from there.
House hacker, huh?
Yeah.
That's great. I love it. Well, that's been really excellent, excellent resources there. Thank you. If people want to reach you or find out more, do you have a way they could contact you?
Sure. Again, I know you're going to link to the website, but the turnkey website is turnkey-reviews.com. I also have another website, which is my personal brokerage website, which is Chicago Brie. Chicago, and then Brie is spelled BRIE.com. And all my contact information is on there.
Excellent. And again, there'll be a link to these resources for those of you driving and maybe trying to write things down here. Everything will be in our show notes section, which is at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog. Of course, it should say /show notes, but that would be too easy. So you'll find it in the blog section. We have a tradition here at the Old Dogs Network that everyone that's a guest gets to give us their best old hound dog howl. So I know, you know, you've probably been practicing all week for this. And so I'm just going to go ahead and just say go ahead and give us your best old hound dog howl. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, go for it.
Oh! My dogs right now are looking at me like, what just happened?
I'm surprised they didn't join in. You know,
I know they're sleeping. Otherwise they would be.
That was a great howl. Great howl. Well, Brie, thank you so much. This has been a great interview. There's so much valuable information there, and also some good follow-up materials for people that you know want to find out more, whether it's turnkey or to get on your website and find out more about what you do as well. And I would add too that you're very active on BiggerPockets, mm-hmm. as I am as well. And I know that people can always reach you through BiggerPockets as well.
Of course.
And I know you've got a lot of good content there as well, as which is how I first became familiar with you. But I think that a great resource and one that we use often here.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's been our pleasure. And hopefully we'll have you back. I think there's a lot of areas, like I said, that I would love to explore and ask more questions about. And whether it's turnkey or just some of your approach to investing, I think, which is worth exploring further. So,
wonderful. I'd love to.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Bree. And thank you, everybody listening. We know that there's a lot of other things that you could be doing right now. And the fact that you've taken the time to join us here means a lot for all of those listening. So please know, and as I mentioned, everything presented here can be accessed in our detailed show notes in the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com. That's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.